Flight attendants, please arm doors, cross-check, standby for all call.
Good morning, ELT listeners.
Welcome aboard this fantastic show.
Please sit back,
fasten your seatbelts, and prepare yourselves for takeoff.
Enjoy the ride.
Hey, ELT listeners. We asked for your factual emergencies about air travel, and you came back with a cargo plane full of questions. On today's show, some answers. From the truth about airplane mode to the truth about airplane sanitation. Let me introduce my flight crew.
My name's Nick Anderson. I'm just finishing my flying career, really, after, 45 years in the air, nearly half a century as a pilot.
Nick flew for the military, and then he worked for Virgin Atlantic, flying internationally.
All long haul. We don't do anything short. So the longest would probably have nearly reached 17 hours of airborne time.
Also in the cockpit, we have Sandy Williams.
This is Captain Sandy.
Sandy Williams flies skydivers now, but before that, she worked for 10 years flying domestically for Delta Connections.
The best thing was flying over the entire United States, seeing all these different places. That was absolutely incredible. I loved it.
So you two are going to be flying this bird together today.
Yeah. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Nick.
Great to meet you.
Yes, great to meet you.
Okay, let's take off with a question that had never occurred to me. It's from listener Jacqueline.
Hello. I'm wondering if it takes a key to start an airplane.
That is a good question.
Oh, I love that, yeah.
I'm imagining like the key that opens the city for the Dreamliner.
Yeah,
giant.
You'd think so. You'd think the captain would be issued with this special key ring with this big thing clanging on their side.
Yes, I fly planes from, a tiny two-seater up to a big plane. So a training plane, if you're learning to fly, you do need a key. And then at a certain level, not very big, there is no key. The key might be to open the door, and then with an airliner, no, there is absolutely no key. It's a starting procedure.
Stealing an airliner, so long as it's pointed in the right direction, would be very easy. And I'm not suggesting people do, but it happened not that long ago. In the United States, a chap stole an A-4 fighter from a base on the West Coast. He flew it around for a good hour doing aerobatics and the like before he brought it back and successfully landed it.
Nick, I'm really glad to know that stealing an airplane is not that hard. I think that's a good take-home fact for our listeners.
You'd be amazed at the number of people that do Microsoft Flight Sim, all that kind of thing,
yeah,
who know intimately how to start up an airplane. It does worry me a little bit.
Does it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I might end up flying one day and then the door will open. There'll be some large gentleman in civilian clothes looking out going, oh, that was fun.
Next up, Katie from North Carolina.
We need to talk about air traffic control. Clearly there's a highway up there or something that keeps planes from bumping into each other. Sometimes you'll look outside your window and you'll see another plane. How do we know where that plane is going? So yeah, I just need to know how air traffic control works.
Nick, is it a highway in the sky?
Certainly in the old days it used to be. And it's funny you should mention that Katie should mention seeing other aircraft because, of course, the separation between our aircraft can be quite small, as little as 1,000 feet.
Really?
Yeah, it looks very close. When another aircraft goes right underneath you and it's only 1,000 feet away, and if someone spots it out of the window, they can get quite alarmed. But that is just perfectly normal. We know about it because usually the air traffic controllers have done the polite thing and told us that another aircraft will be coming close aboard. And we also have a collision avoidance system, which depicts all the aircraft around us.
Sandy?
Well, it's important to realize that the air traffic control system in the United States is like the seventh wonder of the world. Just look on one of the systems, FlightAware or something, where you can see the planes. All these planes going all these places, particularly in the New York area. You've got LaGuardia, JFK, and Newark all squished into the space of like the Orlando International Airport. And things run remarkably efficiently for the squillions of movements per day, It's absolutely remarkable. LaGuardia was my favorite airport, by the way.
Sandy, you're the only person on the planet who's ever said LaGuardia is my favorite airport.
Everybody talk like this. All the controllers, they talk like this, and they talk really fast, and you get yelled at all the time.
Yeah, so the controllers around there are pretty brusque. So, you always had to gird your loins and be prepared to be insulted many times during an approach.
Indeed.
Yeah.
What kind of insults would they throw?
I'll tell you a really good insult from LaGuardia. And it wasn't to me. So it was, I don't know if you remember, Delta used to have some of their 757s painted bright green. And it is a very tiny airport with a lot going on. And so over the ground controller frequency, we all heard, "Yo, big green fat Delta sitting out there on the ramp. You gonna sit there or you gonna do something?"
Is getting insulted particular to New York airports?
Kind of, yeah.
I don't know anywhere else in the world that's really quite as difficult.
They may be cranky, but it is only the top tier of controllers who work there.
Up next, we have a related question from listener Gary.
I've always wondered, when you're on a plane and you get some bad turbulence, afterwards the pilot will often say, "We're going to speed up and make up some time." I've always wondered why they don't just speed up from the start. Who decides how fast a plane should go or how long a trip from one city to another should take?
What would you tell Gary?
Well, I'd say that generally speaking, we're lying.
Really?
We're always trying to get from A to B as fast as we comfortably can. We can sometimes adjust our cruise speed to make up a small amount. I'm talking 5 minutes, perhaps 10 minutes over a long flight, but trying to make up enough to make a significant difference? Nah, it's not going to happen.
Okay, this is the question that we were asked the most, and we've been asked this many times even before we put a call out for airline questions. Do you want to guess what this question is?
I have no idea.
How do you get an upgrade?
That was a question that was asked. So how do you get an upgrade?
Well, there is no real way. The only possible advice would be check in as late as you comfortably can, because if they've already allocated all the seats, then rather than turn you away, they will often move you into a more comfortable part of the airplane, because that's the only room they have left.
The one thing I can say is dress nicely and always be polite. The gate agents and the red coats, they have an incredible amount of power over your life.
Oh, yeah. And a box of chocolates never goes amiss.
After the break, we'll be back with lots more questions, including your FAAQ. The frequent disaster airplane question.
I was just wondering if we really have to put our phones in airplane mode on airplanes.
The answer after the break. Okay, let's get to the most asked question that we got.
Why is it a big deal to turn off your phone when you're on an airplane?
Is the plane going to crash because you have airplane mode turned off?
And he started freaking out, like, "Turn off, turn off, turn off your phone."
What would happen if I don't? What would happen if everyone on the plane didn't? Have there ever been accidents on this?
Well, I can tell you that I would be flying around, and then we'd be making the approach, and you could tell when a phone was on, because all it would do is make this noise on the frequency. And I would say, "My goodness, who didn't turn off their phone?" And then I'd look down and it would be my phone. So as far as I have been ever able to tell, it doesn't interfere with anything. It just makes a little background noise in the cockpit.
Nick?
So here's the secret. A lot of it was to do with the cell technology. You know, your phone has to move from one cell to the other as you move around. Well, when you've got 300 people with phones on and they're doing 500 or 600 miles an hour, all these number of phones all trying to log on to a new cell as the aircraft gets airborne and flies away, it can completely max out the phone system. So it's more a factor that you can bring down, certainly in the early days, the cell phone system. So that was part of it, I think, initially. Certainly the aviation authorities weren't sure what was going to happen when you had hundreds of transmitters on an airplane that hadn't really been properly tested. As time has gone up by and the number of incidents, even suspected incidences, has dropped, people are much less worried about it. But we are in an industry that is hypersensitive to safety. So when you land in bad fog, you're going to let the aircraft land itself using an auto land. And one thing any pilot gets nervous about is if there's anything going to interfere with the signal between your aircraft and all the systems on the ground. And if there's anything in the aircraft that might affect that, it might be a cell phone. So that's just a precaution.
What's the pilot chatter about Boeing's MAX Jet 737, the one that's been involved in the crashes recently?
The pilot chatter is, I would have been absolutely furious if I was at Southwest or American and found out that they put this system in the plane and did not tell me about it. I would be absolutely furious because a pilot needs to know everything going on in the plane. And from what I understand, it was mentioned one time in the appendix with no explanation of what the MCAS system was. So, I am furious, and I don't even fly a 737.
And when you get a mistake of this magnitude that's happened twice, and it's traced back to a mistake that the industry might have made, the manufacturer might have made, that's a pretty serious concern to us.
Next up, a question from Rose.
What do pilots talk about in the cockpit? And sometimes flights are really long. So sometimes I'm on a plane and I'm like watching a movie or sleeping or reading a book, but isn't it really hard on the pilots? And like, how do they entertain themselves up there? Do airlines like make sure that the pilots that fly together get along?
It's quite a personal thing when you're working together with the same person for, several days and you're in the same hotel. And it's a bit lonely if you don't get on with people because, then you're a stranger in a strange city.
Well, but Nick, you know that there's a secret list at every airline.
Say more.
There is a secret list at every airline of the captains that you would rather chew your hand off rather than have to fly with.
Is that true?
It is true. And actually, there's the same for first officers. I once got, when on my rare time on reserve, I got assigned to this trip and I looked at it and I thought, wow, this is a very senior trip. I wonder how I got this. And then I showed up and realized the reason I got it is that the captain didn't want to fly with the first officer, so he called in sick.
Why?
Come on, Nick. Fess up, Nick. You know it's true.
I have to agree. If you get a personality conflict with someone in the cockpit, it can be a pretty dangerous place to be if the first officer and the captain aren't even communicating well.
How much talking do you do? Like, how alert do you need to be while you're on a 17-hour journey?
That's an interesting question because, there are long periods when not a lot's going on, but you're still monitoring it all the time. And there's a lot of strategic thinking. So, you always have to be prepared. If I have an engine failure now or a fuel leak now, where are we going to go and what are we going to do? So you can't just sit there and let the world drift by as pretty as it is. You've really got to stay on the ball, and that can be quite hard. On very long flights, of course, we'll carry extra pilots, and so we'll actually swap over and we'll go to lie down on a special bunk area and have a sleep.
A special bunk area? Where is that?
Well, they're hidden away in various nooks and crannies on the aircraft. So on my aircraft, there was a little compartment directly behind the cockpit with two bunks in. In the new 787s, in the attic area, in the ceiling over the front of the front galley and first part of the first class seats, they're up in the roof is a beautiful little specially designed rest area. And it's very, very lush up there. And it's quiet, sheets up around your chin, and you can't even hear the other bloke snoring, which is fantastic.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like any experience I've ever had on an airplane. Lush, quiet. Lush,
quiet. I tell you, if you got permission to go up there and sleep for your flight, you'd have to pay a lot of money because it's very, very comfortable up there.
Are there rules about not talking in the cockpit?
Yes, it's a sterile cockpit. So other than doing your job, you're not supposed to talk until you're above 10,000 feet.
Really?
Yep, because that's taking off or that's landing, that's doing the departure, that's doing the approach. And then above that, autopilot does the work, then you can safely talk. So below that, it's all business.
What if something funny happens?
Well, if something funny happens, that rule is going to be violated.
Okay, our next question comes from listener Pete.
Yes, I'm wondering why in a commercial airplane, when you're taking off or landing, the seat backs have to be fully upright. I wonder if anybody's life has ever been saved because they have that extra 4 inches forward versus 4 inches back.
That's probably for the person behind, not the person yeah. sitting in the seat. It's for the person behind the seat. If you had a jolt on landing, if you had to do a really abrupt stop, like if you were landing at a super short runway, you could lurch forward. And if that seat in front of you is back, you could hit your head.
There you go, Pete. It's not for you.
It's not for you.
Our next question is about how to tell if your plane is crashing. Let's see. Let's play it.
Hi, this is Cassie from Bowie, Maryland. Are there any telltale signs that, you know, a regular passenger can glean from a flight attendant, you know, that something might be going wrong on the plane?
What should I look for in the eyes of a flight attendant?
Several people moving very fast up and down the aircraft.
Yes,
And the seatbelt signs coming on at an unexpected time. Dings, lots of dings usually going on.
Yes, Nick is correct. Lots of dings, lots of running up and down the aisles, lots of action.
Is there like a particular oh shit ding?
Well, it depends on the aircraft. Every aircraft has a different set of dings, I'm afraid.
Yes, and so for one airline, four dings means we're coming in for landing, and for another airline, four dings means assume the position because we're going to crash. Slightly different ding terminology.
Sandy, I wish you had never told me that. When passengers are in the back, like fearing for their lives on a bumpy landing, what is that like for you guys? Sandy, do you have a landing you remember?
Oh, yes. One of my favorite days of my entire life, I flew over the top of a hurricane and the tail end of it was still lashing New York City. So I was coming in for a landing in LaGuardia and just getting thumped around. And I thought, these poor people in the back, they all think they're gonna die. It was so bumpy, it was so turbulent that they all were just, I'm sure they were white knuckling it and just like, please save our lives. Needless to say, they do not realize that the captain is up there just like, woohoo, happiest day of the year.
Is that classic? I mean, is that how most pilots feel, do you think?
At least for me, I believe most pilots really like intensity. We like to have to really, really focus and really, really concentrate. And when you have to really focus and concentrate is when you're in trying circumstances. And that's usually the weather. And you really have to focus at 110%. So most of us are in flow at that point and having a pretty good time.
Okay, so what happened with the landing?
Well, in LaGuardia, you need to kind of, it's a very short runway, and they would like you to be off halfway down, so you kind of need to hammer it on the end, throw in the reversers. So I did sort of hammer it on the end, throw in the reversers, pulled off, and it was my only spontaneous round of applause from the back because they had all thought they were going to die.
But are we going to die in those situations?
Absolutely not. No, I've been in some pretty severe turbulence. And it hasn't even come close to the aircraft limits. It's just incredibly uncomfortable inside.
Speaking of uncomfortable feelings.
How often do airplane trays get cleaned? See, I work in infectious disease lab, and I can hardly be considered a germaphobe. If anything, I'm sort of a germophile. But my boss and I got into an argument when I told him the only thing I really become a germaphobe for is the airplane tray tables, because there's no way those get cleaned often. And he proceeded to tell me they probably clean it in between almost every flight. And then when I looked it up, it looks like it's maybe once every few months or so. So this has become an ongoing fight that I need the answer to. You can definitely call this an emergency.
Okay, so domestically in America, that turnaround time is going to be really fast. So I absolutely positively guarantee you those tray tables are not being cleaned with any disinfectant. Maybe there's cleaning at night, but it is an absolutely filthy business. I used to, every single leg I would make, let's say it was a super short leg, and I would go back and wash my hands black. Next leg, wash my hands black. So it is a truly filthy business.
I've flown with other pilots who will pull out wet wipes, and they will go around every flight control, everything on the entire flight deck, wiping, cleaning. And if you sneeze without getting your handkerchief out, you get a glare to other people who can make their side of the cockpit look like a trash heap. So they'll have a meal and their entire meal will be spread over all the instruments and over the consoles and everywhere. And, you know, I try and shy over to my side of the cockpit while that's happening, so I don't get hit by the flak, hit by the, shrapnel.
Why is airplane air so terrible?
It's not. It's great.
It's not. It's just super, super dry.
Have you been in the back of the airplane?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you sure?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. It's fresh air. It's just super, super dry, like 2% humidity, and that is really, really hard on your system.
Why not humidify it?
Well, that has its own problems. You can get a lot of mold and stuff forming on the inside of that insulation. It's not nice to have mold on the inside of an airplane. So dry can be good. It preserves the electrics a lot better. It's not good for the passengers terribly. But you're only generally going to spend a few hours in this environment. If you hydrate yourself and use a bit of moisturizer, it's really not going to do you any harm.
Okay, but surely there are things that can do me harm on a plane. So I'm going to give you a list of 5 terrifying scenarios, and I want you to rank them from worst to least worst. Okay, lightning strikes the plane, one engine fails, thunderstorm, tornado, someone puts their bare skin on a tray table.
Let's see. It was thunderstorm, tornado, engine failure, someone puts their bare arm on a table. And what was the other one?
Lightning strikes the plane.
So planes get struck by lightning all the time.
Like, have I probably been in a plane that's been struck by lightning?
Probably.
Oh, yeah. And apart from the big bang and the big flash of light and trying to get your heart, the pacemaker, back to a normal rhythm, that is usually an absolute non-event.
Okay, so we're going to put that one down low. Okay, and so tornado, I'm going to put pretty low because tornadoes are not up at 35,000 feet, and they're also pretty obvious where they might form or where they are, and you don't fly near one.
Thank you. I wouldn't go anywhere near one of those.
And a thunderstorm, generally, you can go around. And then I would say engine failure on that list is the top. What do you think, Nick?
Engine failure, well, I usually have 4 of those. So, and I've lost several in the past, and flying around on 3 engines is pretty much a non-event. Though I'm going to put top of the list tray table.
Okay, ELT listeners, there you have it. Your tray table is the thing to fear the next time you fly. Thanks to everybody who called in with questions.
This is Captain Sandy signing off with Every Little Thing. Hope you enjoyed the show. See you on the next flight.
From Captain Anderson, thank you very much indeed for listening to ELT today. Been an absolute pleasure having you on, and we look forward to chatting to you again before too long. Many thanks.
If you have a burning question that you cannot find the answer to, give us a call. 833-RING-ELT. That's 833-RING-ELT. You can also email us at elt@gimletmedia.com, and we're on Instagram and Twitter at ELT Show.
Nick, if you want to have a really fun retirement job, go fly at a skydiving center. It's the best job ever.
I think English people are way too sensible than to jump out of serviceable airplanes, aren't they?
We get them over here all the time.
Every Little Thing is produced by Aaron Reese, Phoebe Flanagan, Annette Heist, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Our consulting editors are Caitlin Kenny and Jorge Just. Mixed by Dara Hirsch. Scored by Dara Hirsch. For more pilot chatter, look for Captain Nick at the Airline Pilot Guy podcast. I'll have a can of tomato juice, please. Goodbye.